My name is Tommy Andrews and welcome to the SoundSpring podcast. This is the place where creative musicians share the ways in which they turn their stories, ideas, and feelings into sound. During each episode, my guest composers will take you on a guided journey through one of their musical works. This is music, straight from the source. This episode features a regular musical companion and good friend, Tom Green, winner of the 2013 Dankworth Prize for Jazz Composition and 2017 Eddie Harvey Arrangers Award. Tom is a trombonist, composer, and arranger described as a new rising star in the British jazz scene by Jazz FM. I am incredibly lucky to play Tom's stunning music surrounded by some of my favourite musicians in his much-celebrated septet. We'll be exploring a track called Equilibrium from Tom's first album, Skyline. This was recorded just before I joined the band and features Tom on trombone, James Davison on trumpet and flugelhorn, Matthew Hurd on alto saxophone, Sam Miles on tenor saxophone, Sam James on piano, former SoundSpring guest Misha Mulov-Obado on bass, and Scott Chapman on drums. Tom and I also share a strong passion for the outdoors and the environment, and we've shared hiking, mountaineering, and wild camping adventures to some amazing locations. In fact, not long after this was recorded, Tom met up with me whilst I was midway through a multi-day hike, and we had an awesome night stargazing and sleeping out in our hammocks in the hills of the North Downs. But going back to the music, I am so grateful and incredibly excited to be introducing you to Tom Green. Tom Green, thanks for joining us.
No worries, nice to be here.
I'm really looking forward to this conversation because this will be one of the first compositions I featured that actually I get to play on a regular basis. Well, pre-pandemic and post-pandemic, hopefully. So please, can you tell us a little bit about your septet and also tell us a little bit about the record label that you set up, the Spark label?
Sure, yeah. So I started the band, the septet, when I was still at music college, kind of just as an opportunity to write for a bit of a larger ensemble and to explore some different sounds and also to explore some different instruments that I was able to write for and things. And I kind of started just as a compositional project, really, just to have a vehicle to write for. And then it kind of developed into actually a touring band, and now we've released two albums, and it's kind of developed into a band that's got a bit more of its, you know, it's got its own identity now, and it's got its own sound, I think. And I certainly write, when I'm writing a piece, I can tell whether it's a piece that's right for the septet or not. Like, it's now a band that's got its own thing, which is really great. And the first, my first album I released called Skyline was on my own label. I set up my own label called Spark for that release just because I was almost interested in the album releasing process. I guess I kind of wanted to find out about all of the different aspects of releasing an album and what it entailed, and learn about all the random, you know, bits about PRS and BPL and all of these kind of things that were all a bit mysterious before that. So set up my label, and now that label has kind of spun out into having now, I think, 9 releases of various people that I love, musicians that I love, and different kind of projects. And there's quite a wide variety on there as well, which is really nice.
So you've been talking about how your septet has a particular sound in your head. You have become renowned for creating the sonic illusion of a large ensemble using just the 7 parts. And even some live reviews mention the feeling that there's a big band playing and then they look up and there's that kind of juxtaposition moment where you kind of don't believe that there's only 7 people playing. Are there any techniques that you employ to achieve this? And are there any particular influences at play here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm a trombonist. I grew up playing in big bands, and that was really when a lot of my jazz education happened. Because as a trombonist, you know, that's what you hear and that's what you are part of a lot of the time. So that sound has always, I think, been in my head, and the sound of horns playing together in harmony has always been there. So I think that's definitely why I was drawn to a septet, and having four front line, like trumpet, tenor, alto and trombone as a kind of core group. And it's, I guess in a lot of big band writing, there's always, there's a lot of the time it is in four or five parts, like the horn writing is that, and then it's doubled throughout the sections. So actually, if you strip a lot of big band writing back, it does come back to doing four part shapes and voicings between four horns of various kinds, whether that's like trumpets and trombones doubled in four part voicings, like in a bassy style shout choruses or whatever. So it's definitely possible to get that big band sound by using kind of full voicings in a four-part lineup. And then obviously you've got the rhythm section as well, which is nice to be able to use in different ways to just giving them like chords to play. When you start giving them melodies to play with horn players as well, then suddenly you're like, I've got seven musicians here, but I've got seven musicians who can all play in so many different combinations, then you can make it sound like a large ensemble. I mean, one thing that I definitely do when I'm writing and that I like doing is, like, once I've got a chord structure or a melody or whatever, I'll just always harmonize it in some way, probably in several different ways. And I'll probably write a counterline for it, at least one or two or whatever. And then it kind of becomes, assembling a composition kind of becomes a game as to like when you use all of that stuff that you've written. And it's really nice because you've got all this material. You don't need to use it. You know, 70% of it you can just chuck away if you don't like it. But you've got all that material and you can use that. And that's how you can make a composition become like a, you know, have a bigger sound or have a structure or something. You've got all this material, which is really nice.
I like what you're saying about using the rhythm section in a more progressive way like that. I feel maybe Sam James on the piano bears the brunt of this, though, as he's often playing with the horns in one hand and then playing with Misha's bass lines in the left hand. I think he gets the hardest parts out of any of us. I also love that you and so many of my other guests have stressed how helpful it is to be continually flexing their creative muscles. From the way you're talking, it feels as if you're almost creating lots of different jigsaw pieces.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then now and again, you realise through kind of playing with them that some of them fit together.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's and then it becomes, yeah, like I said, it becomes a bit of a playful time that you can have once you've got all that material together. I almost realize at some point when I'm writing a piece, I'm like, oh, this has gone from, you know, creating to assembling and playing and constructing in that way. And in my mind, they're almost two slightly separate things, that you kind of do a brain dump of your material and play with it and try and get as much stuff down on the page as you can, and then you craft it into a composition that you're happy with and a structure that you're happy with.
That's really nice. There's a nice sense of levity to that in comparison to bashing one's head against the piano.
Oh yeah,
that we've all done from time to time.
I've done my fair share of that as well.
Yeah. So we're going to be talking about one of your pieces called Equilibrium. Can you tell us a little bit about the title and whether there are any balances that you're trying to find within this piece?
Yeah, so this is a piece that I wrote quite a while ago, actually. It's on my first album, but it's quite a nice example of a few compositional things that I try and kind of use, or I use regularly. And yeah, the title's definitely about balance between, firstly about between like harmonic movement and stillness in terms of harmony. So a lot of the time there's kind of pedal notes and not much happening with the harmony, and then there's the chord progressions which kind of wind round and round, and so there's the balance between those two things, and then the balance between written material and improvised material as well. A lot of it's quite tightly written, and then there's these big free sections where musicians can kind of go off. And also in terms of the improvisation, the balance between quite constrained improvisation and free improvisation. I mean, there's a point in the track where it just goes completely free. But there's points where it's very much like, this is the structure that I want you to play over, and this is, you know, this is what you have to do. So there's a whole spectrum of improvisation that you can play with by giving musicians different parameters to kind of work with. So a lot of that was what I was kind of playing with that in this composition as well. So there's a few different things that meant the title seemed like a good fit.
This piece also has quite a distinctive sound world within your composition portfolio, I guess you could call it. Could you tell us whether there are any kind of influences that you were exploring at this point?
Yeah, so at the time I was definitely listening to a lot of Maria Schneider, who I love, who's an amazing big band composer. And her release called Concert in the Garden has got a few amazing tunes influenced by kind of South American music, like you know, there's these amazing kind of choro type things with offbeat piano, and also the kind of harmonic minor harmony, which is you kind of hear a bit more. It's kind of, harmonic minor doesn't get talked about very much in kind of jazz education circles, but it's got a whole thing all of its own, the whole sound world all of its own, and definitely that was a lot of what I was playing with in this piece, was that kind of harmonic sound, and also a lot of pedal notes as well, in terms of having a pedal note down and having harmony changing over the top, so you've got this stillness and movement all at the same time.
There's one thing that there's a lot of things I really love about this piece, but one aspect that I really like is how you use a relatively short idea. It's about 8 bars of material, I think, and you manage to spin it out into this long form composition. And I was wondering, what kind of devices are you using to achieve this? And every time this melodic statement comes back, how are you giving each iteration its own identity in order to retain a sense of direction and development?
Yeah, so there's a few things that I use that I quite like using regularly. The first of all is instrumentation, obviously, because in the septet I've got all these different combinations of instruments to use. I mean, this piece starts out with a kind of 4-part horn chorale, but then the main melody is stated by trumpet and trombone in unison to start with. Trombone and tenor in unison. And then the second time the melody comes around, it's trombone and tenor in harmony. And then the alto and trumpet kind of enter with a unison counterline while the trombone and tenor is still in harmony. Then the trumpet and tenor take over the melody, so that's kind of brought the whole melody up an octave from when the trombone and tenor were playing it, with a unison counterline in the other two instruments. And then finally, it eventually ends up in four-part harmony after maybe three or four rounds of the same tune. So even if there wasn't any other development, that's already, you know, every time it comes around, there's a new sound and there's something new that's in the mix, being thrown in the mix. So yeah, that's one thing definitely in terms of instrumentation. And then, I mean, the whole piece is really spun out from one particular compositional device, which is using 7 flat 9 chords as kind of turning points in the harmony. So if you've got like a G7 flat 9, it's basically a G in the bass, and then there's the upper structure on top of that is a diminished seventh. So G7 flat 9 is like an A flat diminished seventh chord with a G in the bass. But equally, you could change the bass note to have B flat, D flat, or E in the bass, and you end up with four different 7 flat 9 chords. And then you can use that kind of device to actually say, hang on, I can modulate from G7 flat 9, I can actually modulate anywhere that those other three 7 flat 9 chords would naturally take me to. So that's kind of how I started then modulating this melody. The piece goes through loads of different keys, and it always does it through choosing one of these dominant chords, which I've got in the melody, which there are quite a few of various different points of that 8-bar form. Choosing one of those and then finding a different key to kind of do a surprising modulation to.
The word play has come up a lot in your approach, and I feel that recently music education has maybe lost this sense of playfulness and curiosity. There's a lot of right and wrong where so much of it becomes quantifiable. Do you feel that by using improvising and playing with ideas and allowing people to follow their ear a bit more, we might start to see a shift towards balancing out technique, which is really important, of course, but balancing out that technique with just as much imagination?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I mean, improvisation should be that, and composition is just improvising in slow motion, as I'm sure you know you've heard before. But it's all about, everything is always guided by your ear and your feelings. And if something feels right to you, like you could have this, you know, this compositional device that feels really academic, or, you know, you've set yourself some kind of very specific parameter to compose between, you know, whether it's a particular ensemble you're writing for or a particular time signature, whatever it is, you know, you can have that, but you've always got to go back to it feeling good and you writing something that you think, yeah, that just feels right to me. And it doesn't need to have any academic justification behind it. It's just because you've messed around with some stuff and you've come up with something, you've created something. And I mean, it's amazing that we can do that as musicians. I think it's such a nice job to have, because you can literally create something out of nothing and generate a feeling in both yourself and in the audience who are listening to it, and that's a real privilege to be able to do, I think.
So after the initial chorale and the first statement of the theme, where you utilise those quite complex harmonic concepts, the harmony suddenly becomes a bit more static underneath the flugel solo. And I was wondering, is this part of your search for equilibrium by balancing out those intricacies from before with something that's now a bit more open?
Yeah, definitely. So the flugel solo, I particularly wanted to be really still and kind of very, very open for the soloist to pretty much do whatever they want. So it's all over a pedal note for a really long time. And there's some very slow changes of harmony over it, but kind of everything drops out at that point. So I really decided that this melody would build and build and build and build and build, and then to have this sudden release, and for that release to last a long time before the next thing builds. And that flugel solo builds in quite a different way to the original melody, whereas the original melody is quite kind of busy with the drums being quite kind of pushy. The flugel solo is much more expansive, and it builds to kind of quite an expansive climax, which is quite a different climax to the original melody. So there's so many ways you can kind of build a tune like that, or you can almost draw the kind of high points and the low points, and the start of this trumpet solo does feel like a bit of a cliff edge, and then a gradual grow again. And you can almost draw that pathway that you want your composition to explore. You can almost do that before you even write anything if you want it. You know, it's just another way of thinking what you're after from writing a piece and setting yourself some kind of parameter to compose to.
Yeah, I really believe that improvising can be at its most powerful when it's used as a part of the onward journey of a piece, instead of everyone just looping round the same 32 bars, for example. Not that there's anything wrong with those kind of structures, but that's just the kind of sounds that I'm drawn to in pieces that I really enjoy. You do this really well in your music. So can you tell us how you are using the two contrasting solo sections between the flugel solo and then the saxophone solos in order to shape the piece?
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I love giving musicians some kind of structure to improvise over. So there's a sense of certainly a start and end point to a solo. You know, you can make that whatever you want. You can give them a really intense start to a solo, and then that solo can wind down and then up again, or you know, it's again, you can trace that path of a solo, but that often you can give the musician control over what journey they want to take to get there, and you can give them more or less control. I mean, the flugel solo in this piece is very, very open, and it's really up to the soloist how he navigates through that quite open chord progression. And then there's this saxophone solo, which is much more constrained because it's like, you know, 6 or 8 bar sections with saxophones trading off each other, and there's some quite almost intrusive backings that come in, which is like, it's deliberate. It's a deliberate compositional device to kind of, you know, give the soloist a bit of a kick up the backside and say, you know, this is how I want you to be playing now, you know, go for this. And as a composer, you can do that as much as you want, and you can give them, you know, it's about choosing how much freedom you want to give the soloist and how much freedom you want as a composer. And there's loads of ways you can do it during a composition as well, because we're jazz musicians and this is like a jazz composition. You can do this kind of thing mid piece. You can loop sections or bring in backings on the fly or whatever, you know, that kind of thing doesn't happen in classical music so much. So there's so many techniques you can use and to kind of give a soloist some kind of pathway through your composition. It's a really nice, and I love using improvisation in that way, because it's just another tool in your composer's toolkit to be able to use.
Yeah, and as part of your toolkit, you then get to use members of your band in a different way. You know the kind of colours and timbres and approaches that they might bring as part of their natural skill set. So instead of fully notated music, where we might have to really meticulously write in loads of performance directions and things like that, you can actually use the intrinsic qualities of a particular player to help shape a piece as they start to influence the musicians around them into reacting alongside their character. So if you want a piece to get darker, you might pick a particular player because of that side of their playing that they bring, or someone might play with quite kind of joyous abandon, or someone might be quite restrained and quite academic in their playing, for example.
Yeah, completely. You can use your musicians' personalities for sure. And it's been really interesting, actually, even with the septet, doing gigs with occasionally people have to dep out or whatever. And it makes these sections that I might have written for a specific musician, it makes them like totally different. And the whole flow of the piece is just different. And it's kind of amazing in a different way, because it's amazing how much influence that personality of that musician and the way that they play and the things that they play, whether it's consciously or subconsciously, influences your writing and then massively influences how the piece turns out at the end of the day when you play it. And in each performance is always different as well. So it's, yeah, super nice.
Also, a lot of people coming into your band for the first time are probably just terrified because your music's so difficult.
Maybe. But then they get to this, then they get to like a big open section with some chord symbols and they're like, yes, freedom.
So we had the flugel solo that was quite still, a bit more serene, then the initial saxophone improvising where the harmony started moving more quickly with all those modulations. And then this all builds up into a section where the saxes and some of the rhythm section are given total harmonic and rhythmic freedom. Is this section conveying something in particular? Is it a bit of a palate cleanser between sections, or is this still part of your quest for equilibrium?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of a combination, really. I mean, partly, I think I felt sorry for the saxophones who I'd given this horrendous solo sequence to play over, going through like 10, 12 different keys or whatever, I don't know, over the course of you know, a couple of minutes, building and building and building. It is a little bit, and I think I just wanted to, once that had built to a climax and kind of both the saxophones are playing together, like there's these really like high backings in trumpet and trombone, I just wanted it to completely just kind of explode almost in terms of just everything would just dissolve and go, and that this, and the, I think, yeah, it was partly for the musicians just to say, you know, go, have your fun, you know, you've got through it, well done, hooray, you know. But it's definitely also, it's obviously in service of the composition as well, and it's obviously a, a balance again, some kind of equilibrium between the really intense harmonic changes that have gone before, and then just to have this open, like C minor-ish, free, do what you want bit, which then kind of calms down a little bit. It's I think it's necessary for the whole composition and for the listener as well to have some kind of respite from quite in kind of constantly changing harmony.
So after this quite intense free improvising, we're treated again to more iterations of your original theme. We must be about 11 minutes or so into the piece by now, but still you're managing to keep it fresh. And every time this melody occurs, it just has like a new energy. So can you explain how you're doing this?
Yeah, so obviously the time's all dissolved and everything's completely stopped, and there's no rhythm anymore. So the first thing is definitely to play with it. The first statement is completely out of time, with the trumpet and trombone kind of just answering each other, this little melody and counter melody. And actually the melody and counter melody, actually the two-part harmony that the tenor and trombone played at the start of the tune, right back at the start, I just kind of wrote the harmony and then just pulled apart the actual harmony part from the original melody part and just separated them. So you hear like the melody part and then the harmony part and then the melody part and then the harmony part in free time. So it's like the same material, but just put together in a different way. And then that kind of carries on and the saxes join in with in unison with the trumpet and trombone, and the rhythm section at this point I told them just to start going into time slowly. So the whole first statement of the melody is like out of time going into time, and then by the time you get to the second statement of the main melody again, we're like back in time, but this time the rhythm section are really kind of pushing almost. And there's like, I kind of instructed them in rehearsals and in their parts and everything that this should be a real, like, kind of, not a rush, but like it should feel unstoppable at this point, that this kind of, this rhythm and movement is just going to carry on and carry on and carry on and reach another climax till the end. And then of course there's one final little modulation that I put in at the end with a trumpet counterline that you haven't heard before. So there's another trumpet counterline and there's a modulation, I think, literally in the second bar of the tune now. Whereas the previous modulations were all in like bar 4 and bar 6 of the melody. This is like...
Yeah, with these modulations appearing slightly sooner than you're expecting, plus the rhythm section given this instruction to start moving on the intensity, there's this real sense of inevitability, like something's really going to happen.
Completely, yeah, and that's kind of what I wanted, because it's been such a long tune up to there. I just wanted this kind of like this kind of unstoppable energy to kind of just get to the end of the piece and then, you know, just disappear again. And then there's just this last statement of the horn chorale that started the piece to finish again. So, which kind of, but those are just kind of bookends, really. So yeah, it just felt like that's what it needed at that point, just this kind of last injection of energy. And this time it comes from the rhythm section rather than the soloists, for sure.
Fantastic. Well, we've got to the end of Equilibrium. And
actually, I should say there's one more thing. One more thing, which is that when I wrote this piece, I tried desperately hard for it to start and finish in the same key, which it doesn't do. And like, it finishes a tone out from where it started. And it just felt like that wasn't... I think it's always frustrated me that I never quite managed to fix the modulation so that it...
Does it still frustrate you when we play it on gigs?
Not really, but... So I think it kind of does a little bit. I think
across when we're playing it, will I see you grimacing out the corner of my eye?
It's not quite that bad. I think it's just like, oh, have I reached like true equilibrium with this tune? You know, it doesn't start and finish in the same place. Is that really like... Has that brought balance? I don't know. But I just thought I should mention that as a personal bugbear.
Well, thanks for sharing all of the pain you must be going through listening to it again. Anyway, I've got some quick questions that I've been asking everyone. So are you ready to run the gauntlet?
All right. Yeah, let's do it. Fire away.
So I would like to know, what kind of things would you like to see put in place to make music education veer a little bit more towards creativity and self-expression?
Yeah, that's an awesome question. I'm quite passionate about that, actually, because I think there's been a lot of music education makes kids almost afraid to like play again, and play not in the sense of like playing your instrument, but experiment and just have fun with it. So maybe the change that I'd make is just take away sheet music for like the first two grades equivalent of study or something. Just have no, because it's like an extra barrier sometimes I find between hearing something in your head and expressing it on your instrument. And there's this page of music that's in front of you often, which I think kids kind of learn that's what the music is. It's that writing on the page, and that's not what music is. It's not what music is to me. Music's the sounds that you're making, and you should be able to hear that in your head before you play anything. You know, even if it's a piece you've learned, whatever it is.
Yeah, I think you're right there. One of the things that makes me sort of despair and chuckle at the same time is sometimes when I'm at school or doing an education project or something, someone will be playing something and then they'll say, oh yeah, that's a grade three piece, but it might have been some Mozart or Schumann, yeah, or Bach or something, and then I'll be like, I'm pretty sure they didn't write that just to be a grade two piece or grade three,
exactly,
piece. And then you'll be setting up a rehearsal and you'll hear these kids kind of sitting down next to each other, and one will turn to the other, and the first thing you'll hear is, oh, so what grade are you?
Yeah.
As if it really matters. And it's like, when did music become
exactly
that? Why is that the most important thing?
Yeah. It's such a shame that it's all these You know, it's hoops always. And it's not, I don't know whether I have an actual problem with grades and exams per se, but I certainly think the focus should be on, like, you've picked up a musical instrument, like, you should just, like, get to know that instrument. And there's no reason why kids can't start finding their own voice and their own sound on that instrument from day one. Like, obviously, it's important to get a good technique together and all of this stuff, but there's no reason why you can't start expressing yourselves from the word go. And I find it, you know, I often go and teach improvisation workshops, and the, you know, a lot of kids come in and they've never, they kind of have a disconnect between actually being able to play anything that they hear on their instrument. And it's almost as if sometimes, like, there's a disconnect between them listening to music that they like and them playing a musical instrument. That I feel like it can become like two different things, rather than listen to music that you like and then try and imitate it. Like, they're one and the same thing, rather than, like, on my trumpet I play the music that's put in front of me and that's what I do. And then I like listening to, you know, I don't know, whatever it is, Lady Gaga or whatever. But I've never tried playing Lady Gaga on the trumpet, because I play the grade two music on the trumpet. That's what I do. So I think blurring those boundaries, and just from the start, there's no reason why you can't be like, you know, what do you listen to? What are you into musically? What do you want to do? And then, as a music educator, you know, there's no reason why you can't start kids off being like, cool, let's do that.
That's great advice. Speaking of advice, is there anything that springs to mind if I was to ask, what's the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
Best piece of advice. Actually, I'm going to change the question, because I'm going to make it the best book that I've ever read, which is advice for an artist, and it's called Steal Like an Artist. It's a little coffee table book, and it's totally brilliant. It's got all these amazing little pieces of advice about being creative, like, don't wait until you know who you are to get started, just, you know, go. Or, like, be nice, the world is like a small village. And, you know, the title is like, Steal Like an Artist. So just nick things that you like, copy things that you like, and work out what they are and deconstruct them and make that into your, put those things into your repertoire of being creative. So, yeah, thoroughly recommend that little book. It's really, really nice. And I've not seen that kind of advice anywhere else particularly.
Is there a particular piece of music or an album, something that inspires you to this day that you think you'll always go back to?
It's probably got to be something I listened to when I was a teenager. And I kind of grew up listening to loads of different music, and, like, from prog metal to, like, obviously jazz and everything in between. But there's one album just by the rock band Feeder that I totally love, and it's called Comfort and Sound, and it's awesome. And it, every time I put it on, it's just like, it just gives me, like, it's because it's got all these memories of me listening to it all through my life. And it's just got some really nice, like, simple songs with, like, lovely string arrangements, and, like, it's just a super comforting album for me. So yeah, Feeder, Comfort and Sound, that's the one.
Great, thanks for that. Do you have a particular musical moment that gives you the biggest goosebumps or rush of emotion?
Probably the Rachmaninoff Variations on a Theme by Paganini. And it's famous, and it's, like, played on Classic FM every 3 seconds. But that particular movement of that piece, and there's just some particular chords that Rachmaninoff uses in the string writing and in the piano writing, and that's just, yeah, just gets me every time. And I also love that piece because it's like the perfect example of a composer picking some kind of parameter to play with, like that whole variations on a theme suite is like loads of different ways of cutting up this original tune, and that particular famous variation is like the original melody backwards, so inverted, and it just creates this really like beautiful melody. So yeah, that one gets me every time for sure.
So you can ask one composer anything. Who would it be, and what would you ask?
It would be Gil Evans, I think, and it would be about instrumentation and how he puts instruments together and how he gets, because he's like one of those composers that just is able to generate sounds using multiple instruments that I would never think of or be able to do. So it's like, you know, he uses like alto flutes and French horns and stuff and all these kind of weird and wacky instrumentations together, and like how he comes up with those combinations of instruments and how he puts those unusual ensembles together to create like those distinct sounds. Yeah, I'd love to chat to Gil.
Which composer would you bring back to life in order to hear some of the music being made today, and also maybe hear how their music is played today as well?
Yeah, good question. I think I've got to go for the obvious answer here and just say Bach, because I just love to see him like go into a late night jam session and just tear it up, because I'm pretty sure that he would.
So someone has come up to you and given you a blank check for a project. I would like to know what you would do.
I think I'd make a list of all my favourite musicians and go basically on a road trip or some kind of journey to go and actually visit them where they live and where they, you know, hang out and their environment, and try and make a piece of music with each of them in their own kind of habitat, if you see what I mean. Because I think it's where you, the environment you surround yourself with is so important in terms of the music you make. And I'd love to just go and like visit these people that I really admire and try and make music with them and investigate what it is that kind of makes them tick in a way, whether that's like the natural world or whether it's like some specific, you know, influences they have in their known lives. And so I'd love to go, like, it would kind of be like interviews and like composing and performing and recording, and it would be like this elaborate kind of multi-album project, I guess. That would be great. It'd be really fun.
That's such a great idea. Can I come as well? I really hope you can make that happen. Right, last question. I think this is my favourite. You can go to any musical happening in history, whether it's a concert or a recording session or rehearsal. What would you go and witness?
I think it would have to be like the Basie band at the height of Basie, probably Basie Sinatra, like at the Sands or something, like one of those like just classic gigs. And I'd be in the front row and it'd be awesome.
Thank you so much. So how can we all keep in touch and follow what you're up to?
So I've got a website, so that's tomgreenmusic.com. And my label website is Spark Labels, so sparklabel.com. And we've got kind of all the releases and stuff on there. And then I've got all the usual things, you know, Facebook, Twitter, social media. I don't really do Twitter anymore. I don't know why I said Twitter. Facebook. But website's the best way, and I got a mailing list and everything. So all my gigs will go up on there when there are gigs.
When there were gigs sounds like a new track title for you, Tom. Anyway, thank you so much for your time. Anyone that is listening to this, please go and check out Tom's music, the Scepter albums, Skyline and Tipping Point, and also some of the stuff that Tom's been releasing on the Spark label. It's all really good stuff. Tom, I can't wait to play with you again and play your music. And thank you so much for your time. It's been a really fun discussion and I really hope to see you soon.
Yeah, great. Thanks for having me. It was really fun.
Thank you for tuning into this episode with Tom. We'll be back for episode 10 on the 2nd of February, featuring Ray Hearn. There probably aren't many people who can say they are a conservatoire-trained orchestral tuba player, as well as being voted as one of the best progressive metal drummers in the world. Ray happens to be one of these people. As part of British prog metal giants Haken, Ray's drumming and writing form an important part of the musical diet for millions of metalheads all across the globe, including myself. So tune in from the 2nd of February, make sure you crank up the volume and let your hair down for this one. It's going to be great. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to keep in touch, visit us at soundspring.co.uk. You can connect with us on Instagram by searching for Soundspring Pod, or you can send us an email at soundspringpodcast@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. If you like what you've heard, please spread the word and don't forget to give us a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. It really helps us to reach new listeners. If you enjoy the show and want to support our podcast, you can donate or become a patron of the show at patreon.com/soundspringpodcast. Obviously, we encourage you to go and buy our guests' music. But once you've done that, and only once you've done that, you can also stream most of the music featured in the show by searching for the Soundspring Podcast playlist in Spotify. And finally, I'd like to thank Katie Stevenson for her beautiful artwork. Please go and follow her work on social media by searching for Cub and Bloom. This is Tommy Andrews, signing off until next time.